Are we ready? Don't let's waste 1 minute. I love these indulgences. You see, it's an indulgence for me to read poetry, so I don't want you to miss any of it out. And thank you so much for my flowers and my hats. I feel like Mrs. Dalloway. She said she'd buy the flowers herself. She's going to have a party in the evening. Well, today it's somebody not quite in the same category as Virginia Woolf, Yevtushenko. And I'm hoping that you will love some of his poetry anyway as much as I do. I'm many-sided, I'm overworked, and idle too. I have a goal, and yet I'm aimless. I don't, all of me, fit in. I'm awkward, shy, and rude, nasty, and good-natured. I love it when one thing follows another, and so much of everything is mixed in me, from west to east, from envy to delight. I've seen myself in every aspect. I feel kin to Yesenin and Walt Whitman and Mussorgsky, grasping the whole stage, and Gauguin's pure virgin line. I like to use my skates in winter, and scribbling with a pen spend sleepless nights. I like to defy an enemy to his face and bear a woman across a stream. I bite into books and carry firewood, pine, seek something vague. And in the August heat, I love to crunch cool scarlet slices of watermelon. I sing and drink, giving no thought to death. With arms outspread, I fall upon the grass. And if in this world I come to die, then I shall die from sheer joy of living. I wanted to open by reading you that poem by Yevtushenko of himself, at the start of his poetic career, because it seems to me to bring out three of the qualities I admire most in him: his honesty, his sheer joy in life, and his willingness to embrace every aspect of it. I also wanted to illustrate how autobiographical his poetry is for this course. Of course, I have to try and argue that, even if it isn't true. He began what he rightly called a precocious biography, published in Paris in 1963, when he was only 30, with the assertion that a poet's autobiography is his poetry. Anything else can only be a footnote. A poet is only a poet when the reader can see him whole, as if he held him in the hollow of his hand, with all his feelings, thoughts, and actions. It's a lovely read. Precocious biography, do get hold of it. It's a real revelation about life in Russia at the time, and of course about Yevtushenko. Like Thomas Hardy, with whom this course started, Yevtushenko's main subject is himself and his daily experiences in all their variety. And as we see, shall see, Yevtushenko does not hesitate to include politics in this. As anyone writing in 20th and 21st Russia, century Russia, must do. But his chief interest is in how this affects himself and the millions of ordinary people in Russia like himself. He is, at one and the same time, an autobiographer with a strong lyric impulse and a fully engaged civic poet, quite a difficult act, which has attracted fierce criticism from some. Some of you will know that Yevtushenko has not always been very popular and is not. And when you see him reciting, and one of his many roles in life is as an actor, you will see that a certain amount of jealousy enters into this too. No man has a right to so many talents. The accessibility of Yevtushenko's poetry, much of it narrative and full of visual detail, expressed in a rich conversational language and haunting rhythms, conveyed sadly in only the most sensitive of translations, and I realize this, you must forgive the translations, because some of them are better than others. You must go with the sense rather than the sound, which is sad, isn't it? There are some of them that really do work, and I've tried to select those. His choice of themes is equally important, particularly that of romantic love. But he's not limited to that. One of his first, and I think most people would agree his most, one of his most amazing achievements, is Zema Junction, which deals not only with himself, with his family background in this small little town on the Trans-Siberian Railway, its history and its nature, but also the wider theme, the moral consequences of political corruption, which most people are familiar with, whatever the country they come from, and of the shocking revelations that followed Stalin's death in 1953, the year the poem was begun, the year Yevtushenko, born in 1933, was only 20. Youth itself is perhaps the central theme of Zema Junction, which is ostensibly a description of the narrator's return at the age of 20 to the place where he originated, Zema. A small town on Lake Baikal. I've actually gone through Zema. When I was one of those students who couldn't do anything but travel, always without money, of course, I went on the Trans-Siberian Railway across Russia and was amazed to find the vastness of Russia. What do they do in the winter, somebody said to me. Make babies? That was a Canadian, obviously a very uncultured man. There might be a Canadian in the audience. So he was, Yevtushenko was born here into a peasant family, mixed Ukrainian, Russian, and Tatar blood in 1933. As he proudly points out in a precocious autobiography, revolution was the religion of our family. His great-grandfather was a peasant from the Zhytomyr province, was deported to Siberia, because of course it's in Siberia, so most of the people out there are rather like the people in Australia. You see, first I insult the Canadians, now the Australians. The Australians, the English regard as the exported convicts. The same with Siberia, of course. All the troublemakers were sent to Siberia. His maternal, well, the great-grandfather was sent there for setting fire to his landlord's house in protest, which was rather splendid. His maternal grandfather, Yermolay Yevtushenko, a soldier in the First World War, who could barely read, was one of the organizers of the peasant movement in the Urals and East Siberia. Later, he studied at the Red Military Academy, becoming a brigade commander, and held the post of deputy commanding officer in the newly formed Russian Republic. You remember the Russian Republic came about in 1917. His paternal grandfather, I hope you're not getting too confused yet, Rudolf Gangnes, whose family came from Latvia, was arrested on a charge of spying for Latvia. All three were very proud of their peasant origins, as Yevtushenko, now in his 80th year, now still is, still alive and still going strong. The children of peasants or workers in post-revolutionary Russia were sent to university as a matter of principle, one of the great things to come out of the revolution. And Yevtushenko's parents met there in the 1920s, where both were studying geology. From his father, he learned to love books, he says. And he tells and remembers his father reciting an extraordinary range of poets. Perhaps we could have a course centered around Yevtushenko's father's readings. Listen to this. You probably say no when I tell you. Lermontov, Goethe, Poe, and of all writers, Rudyard Kipling. He said he recited If with a sense that he had written it himself. And from his mother he learnt a deep love of the soil, which he still retains. A lot of his writing is about the soil, certainly in Zema Junction, and of working with his hands. From his birthplace, Zema, he learned many things, especially on his return there at the age of 20 that I mentioned. This is extract 3. As we get older, we get honester. That's something. A And these objective changes correspond like a language to me and my mutations. If the way you see me now is not the way in which we saw you once, if in you what I see now is new, it was by self-discovery I found it. I realize that my 20 years might be less than mature, but for a reassessment, what I said and ought not to have said, and ought to have said, and was silent. My life has often been by backward glances, few personal emotions, thoughts or wishes. And in my life, it's even turns and courses, some generous impulse, but nothing finished. Yet always hear these means for a new design, new strength, touching the same ground where you first moved, barefooted, kicking up dust. I rely often on this ordinary thought, near Lake Baikal, my own town, waiting for me. And the wish to see the pines again, mute witnesses of time and its distance, of my great-grandfather, and of the others in exile here after a peasant's rising, here herded from extremities of distance through mud and rain with small children and wives, Ukrainian peasants from Zhytomyr province. The trees had spiders' webs in wanderings, finding fortitude to forget what each of them loved more than his life. The guards looked with uneasy eyes at hands heavy with veins. And the sergeant sat playing by firelight, clubs were trumps. All the night through, my great-grandfather sat thinking there and lighted up his pipes with a fiery coal held in his peasant fingers. What did he think of? Yevtushenko, who has kept his deep love of nature and the land, as I say, paints a lyrical picture of a largely untroubled early childhood in Zima, in Siberia. This is extract 4. So the years went past one after the other. I grew up in the small town, acquiring an affection for the forest and landscape and the quiet houses. I grew up at hide and seek, uncatchable whatever guard you kept. We peered out from the barns through bullet holes. There was a war at that time. Hitler, not far from Moscow. And we were children and accepted a lot, lightly. From classroom threats, untroubled and forgetful, we tore away out of the playground and ran down through fields to the river, broke open a money box and ran away to look for the green mare, baited our wet hooks. I used to go fishing, stuck paper kites, or often wandering by myself, bareheaded, sucked at clover, grass polished my sandals. I know the black acres, the yellow hives, the luminous clouds that dropped, still lightly stirring, half out of sight behind the immense horizon. And skirting around outhouses, used to listen for the neighing of the horses. Peacefully and tiredly, fell asleep in old hayricks, long darkened by the rain. I scarcely had one single care in the world. My life, presenting no big obstacles, seemed to have few or simple complications. Life solved itself without my contributions. I had no doubt about harmonious answers, which could and would be given to every question. But suddenly, this felt necessity of answering these questions for myself. So I shall go on where I started from. Sudden complexity, self-generated, disturbed by which I started on this journey. But it was not until his return at 20 that Yevtushenko fully realized what his humble little town had to teach him, which becomes the message of most of the poetry to follow. He is about to leave the town again in this next and last passage, having spent some days meeting family and friends and drinking a lot of vodka, I have to say. I love the way Russians swill vodka without any apparent effect. Everything seemed younger. No, sorry, I won't start there. I'll start about 13 lines down at nothing exceptional. Nothing exceptional. Not hot, not cold. Sorry, not cold, not hot. It was a day like any other one. But such a crowd of pigeons in the air. I was someone good, young, going away. I felt sad and clean, and sad perhaps because of having learned something, and yet not knowing what. I drank some vodka to my friends and strolled through Zima Junction one more time. It was a day like any other one. The trees, their brilliant shivering foliation, luminous green against the ground. A few boys throwing rubbish at a wall. A queue of lorries stretching. Women at market among the cows and different sorts of fruit. Sad and free, on and on I passed the last house, climbed into the sun, and for a long time stood on the hilltop, looking across at the station buildings and farmhouses and barns. And the voice of Zima Junction spoke to me, and this is what it said. I live quietly and crack nuts. I gently steam with engines, but not without reflection on these times, these modern times, my loving meditation. Don't worry. Yours is no unique condition, your type of search and conflict and construction. Don't worry if you have no answers ready to the lasting question. Hold out. Meditate. Listen. Explore. Explore. Travel the world over. Count happiness co-natural to the mind more than truth is, and yet no happiness to exist without it. Walk with cold pride, utterly ahead, wild attentive eyes, head flicked by the rain-wet green needles of the pine, eyelashes that shine with tears and with thunders. Love people. Love entertains its own discrimination. Have me in mind. I shall be watching. You can return to me. Now go. I went, and I'm still going. You've all been back to your childhood home. Besides, imparting wisdom to Yevtushenko, Zima would also serve as a background for his country characters, landscape, and forest scenes in his poetry. The famed Siberian tiger, I hope you, that's how you say it, T-A-I-G-A, and be a rich source of folklore and folk song with which he would enrich his later poetry. So he learned a lot practically and philosophically from Zima. By the time he left Zima for the first time as a child, he was already reading voraciously under his father's extraordinary influence. I mean, fancy. Have you a child at the age of eight having read Dumas, Flaubert, Schiller, Balzac, Dante, Maupassant, Tolstoy, Boccaccio, Shakespeare, Jack London, Cervantes, and H.G. Wells? It's an extraordinary man. I want to know more about the father. It all made what he calls an indescribable salad in his head, and he lived in an illusory world, probably tilting at windmills. So much so that he didn't notice that his father and mother were what he calls estranged, always a very sad moment in a child's life. And only staying together, he writes, for their son's sake. When they finally separated in the late 1930s, Yevtushenko went with his mother to Moscow, later taking her maiden name. You may have noticed that it's his maternal grandfather, Yevtushenko. Her name because he owed so much to her. He was not an easy child. In fact, I'd have given him up long ago. He got into trouble everywhere, for everything, sometimes the things he did and sometimes the things he didn't do. He was finally expelled from school at the age of 15 for something he didn't do. And that was it. He never went back. His appreciation and love of her comes through clearly in a poem like Birthday, which is number 2 on your sheet. Even if you're a father, I think you'll be able to identify. Mother, let me congratulate you on the birthday of your son. You worry so much about him. Here he lies, He earns little. His marriage was unwise. He's long. He's getting thin. He hasn't shaved. Oh, what a miserable, loving gaze. I should congratulate you, if I may, Mother, on your worry's birthday. It was from you that he inherited devotion without pity to this age. And arrogant and awkward in his faith from you, he took his faith in revolution. The revolution. You didn't make him prosperous or famous, and fearlessness is his only talent. Open up his windows, let in the twittering in the leafy branches. Kiss his eyes open, give him his notebook and his ink bottle, give him a drink of milk and watch him go. By 1941, I mean, this was troubled in many ways, this childhood, because by 1941, he is eight now at this time, Hitler was at war with Russia and marching on Moscow. And in the autumn of 1941, Yevtushenko was evacuated, like many other Moscow children, to Siberia. It took him a whole month to reach his native Zima Junction, travelling in a train of 16 coaches filled with women and children. And as he puts it himself, they were 16 coachloads of grief and tears. Slowly moving deep into the Russian hinterland. And towards them, heading for the front, came trains packed with guns and young, very young, conscripts. Worse awaited him when he finally arrived at Zima itself, where he witnessed, in his words, what perhaps was the most terrible thing I have seen in my life, the weddings of 1941. Young boys called to the front, he writes, were handed their papers and given 2 or 3 days to get ready. The times were grim. The German general Guderian was looking Moscow over through his field glasses. Nobody ever knows why he didn't attack. I think it was because Hitler forbade him to, or the other generals. But it was an extraordinarily lucky chance for the Muscovites. These young men whose bodies were to block his way to Moscow had hardly any chance of coming back. Many of them were engaged, and their girls chose to be their wives, if only for a day, and at the cost of being widowed at once. That's what Yevtushenko writes. As a good folk dancer, even as a child, Yevtushenko was taken to dance, at the age of only eight, to dance at weddings. Traditionally, both weddings and dancing are an occasion for joy. And of course, here they become horrific. It becomes, or the music and the dancing become horrific manifestations of the opposite, that is, desperation and suffering as the young men go off to war. This is number 6 on your sheets. Those weddings in wartime. The deceiving comfort, the dishonesty of words about living, sonorous, slow, snowy roads. In the wind's wicked teeth, I hurry down them to a hasty wedding at the next village. With worn-out tread and hair down in my eyes, I go inside, I, famous for my dancing, into the noisy house. In there, tensed with nerves and with emotion, among a crowd of family, friends and family, called up, distraught, the bridegroom, sitting beside his Vera, his bride. We'll in a few days put his greatcoat on and set out, coached for the war. We'll see new country, carry a rifle. They also drop if he is hit. His glass is fizzing, but he can't drink it. The first night, maybe the last night. And sadly eyeing me, and bitter-minded, he leans in his despair across the table and says, come on, then dance. Drinks are forgotten. Everyone looks round. Out I twirl to begin. Clap of my feet, shake, scrape the floor with my toe cap, whistle, whistle, slap hands faster, leaping, ceiling high, moving the posters pinned up on the wall. Hitler kaput. Her eyes, that's the bride, of course, her eyes streaming with tears. Already soaked in sweat and out of breath, dance, they cry out. out in despair, and I dance. When I get home, my feet are log heavy. Some drunken people from another wedding turn up behind me. Mother must let me go, they say. The scene again. I see it. And again, beside the edge of a trailing tablecloth, I squat down to dance. She weeping, and her friends weeping. I, frightened, don't feel like dancing. But you can't not dance. I don't know whether you've seen the film The Deer Hunter. That extraordinary, terrible party as the men go off to Vietnam. At a wedding, the party is. As you probably know, the Germans failed to take Moscow, and Yevtushenko eventually returned there to live with his mother again. Though his education was troubled, culminating at 15, as I say, in being expelled from school, he was determined to be a poet. My mother, he said, didn't want me to become a poet. Well, money was short, she was quite right. He published his first poem in 1949 in a Moscow sports paper, which may seem a rather strange. I said it's Siegfried Sassoon, actually, only his was in a cricket paper. But they were both good sportsmen. And there was a point in his life where Yevtushenko had to toss up between being a professional footballer or a poet. I'm so glad he chose poetry. It's a lovely poem called On a Bicycle, which shows the pleasure in physical activity, if you want to look it up. And in 1952, after a few years working intermittently in Kazakhstan, where he joined his father on geological expeditions, he brought out his first poetry collection. This contained largely apprentice work. It was called Prospectors of the Future, obviously with an allusion to the geological surveys. But it was definitely apprentice work. And it was not until after the death of Stalin in 1953 that he began to show real promise as a poet, possibly because by then he felt he really had his subject. The first great flowering of Russian poetry, led by Alexander Pushkin, 1799 to 1837, so a long time before Yevtushenko, and his disciple Lermontov, 1814 to 1844, was at the beginning of the 19th century, but the second was at the beginning of the 20th. And Yevtushenko is born after that second flowering, which contained all sorts of amazing movements that I don't understand anything about, like symbolism, futurism, acmeism, what's acmeism? Constructivism, imagism, and poets such as Bloch, Pasternak, Mayakovsky, Akhmatova, Lesenin, and Mandelstam, some of them you will have heard of. And so he was born just as this period was coming to an end. By 1934, the year after his birth, all but a few of the great poets of the revolution were dead. And if they weren't, they were not writing very much poetry, if at all, after it. There were, it is true, a certain number of talented poets publishing during the 30s and 40s, and there was a great deal more poetry written during the Second World War. But Stalin's Minister of Culture, Kukov, by 1948, made it clear, according to one literary authority of the period, that the outlook for imaginative poets was no more favourable than in the 30s. And for the rest of Stalin's lifetime, that is until the early 50s, there was very little poetic activity. So Yevtushenko was not born in an easy place, and he wasn't born at an easy time. It is therefore probably no coincidence that his emergence occurs round about the time of Stalin's death, though he himself confesses that, like most Russians growing up at the period, he began by worshipping Stalin. I've never understood this, but he speaks very convincingly of how charismatic Stalin was, and therefore how difficult it was to come to terms with what they could see was extremely destructive to their culture and their race. But by the time of his death in 1953, Yevtushenko had begun to see how evil his influence and actions had been. Though his protest against Stalin's legacy, which is called The Heirs of Stalin, was not published until 9 years after his death, that is in 1962, Yevtushenko made no secret of his views. And I want to emphasize this because he has been criticized for cozying up to the government. And actually, if you follow his life through, you will see that he was very brave in standing up to them. He was risking not just punishment, but banishment. The Heirs of Stalin is an extraordinary poem. It speaks of the hurt and damage done by Stalin, the distrust he had sown, the prison camps he'd filled, the youth he perverted, the people's good he had neglected, the innocent men he had jailed. And this poem really established Yevtushenko, because he was speaking for the people who had suffered. And as this poem, which starts as an elegy, turns into a condemnation, notice how the imagery itself takes flight. There's a wonderful image of a telephone in Stalin's coffin, which I think you'll like, hopefully. The Heirs of Stalin, number 7. Mute was the marble, mutely glimmered the glass, mute stood the centuries bronzed by the breeze, but thin wisps of breath seeped from the coffin when they bore him out the mausoleum doors. Slowly the coffin floated by, grazing the fixed bayonets. He was also mute, he also, but awesome and mute. Grimly clenching his embalmed fists, he watched through a crack inside, just pretending to be dead. He wanted to fix each pallbearer in his memory, young recruits from Ryazan and Kursk, in order somehow later to collect strength for a sortie and rise from the earth and get to them, the unthinking. He has worked out a scheme. He's merely curled up for a nap. And I appeal to our government with a plea to double and treble the guard at this slab so that Stalin will not rise again, and with Stalin, the past. We sowed crops honestly. Honestly, we smelted metal. But he feared us. Sorry, and honestly, we marched in ranks as soldiers. But he feared us. Believing in a great goal, he forgot that the means must be worthy of the goal's greatness. He was far-sighted, wily in the ways of combat. He left behind him many heirs on this globe. It seems to me that a telephone was installed in the coffin. To someone, once again, Stalin is sending out his instructions. To where does the cable yet go from that coffin? No, Stalin did not die. He thinks death can be fixed. We removed him from the mausoleum. But how do we remove Stalin from Stalin's heirs? Some of his heirs tend roses in retirement, but secretly consider their retirement temporary. Others from platforms rail against Stalin, but at night yearn for the old days. It is no wonder Stalin's heirs with reason today visibly suffer heart attacks. They, the former henchmen, hate a time when prison camps are empty and auditoriums where people listen to poetry are overfilled. My motherland commands me not to be calm, even if they say to me, be assured, I am unable. While the heirs of Stalin are still alive on this earth, it will seem to me that Stalin still lives in the mausoleum. Extraordinary, isn't it, the way in which he uses that metaphor of being alive, and you actually almost frightened in the end that he will get up out of the coffin. Very gruesome poem. Yet, and a very brave poem to have written. Yet Yevtushenko saw his criticism of Stalin as in no way a criticism of communism. The romantic ideals of the workers and soldiers who stormed the Winter Palace in 1917, he says, were still as dear to him by the late 1940s as they are to him today at the age. age of nearly 80. Soviet restrictions on writers, rigid under Stalin, began to relax shortly after his death, when some critics felt bold enough to call for more lyricism. You know, this socialist realism, which Yevtushenko found so difficult, in which one must just talk about the state, the good of the state, not a subject that always adapts itself very well to poetry, of course. This was particularly welcome news to Yevtushenko, that Khrushchev was allowing what became known as the thaw, who felt unable to conform to the demands of the socialist realism. As a poet, he could not be merely negative and critical, social and political, ethical and moralistic, as the movement demanded. It seemed to him, in the words of one of his biographers, George Reevey, that poetry is the language of the emotions and feelings, a form of aesthetical affirmation and ideal statement. He helped carry forward the lyrical revival, which had been formally put forward by Pasternak. And it's in this period, in the late 50s and early 60s, that some of Yevtushenko's tenderest love lyrics were written. But don't fall in love with him. He's been married four times, and he's obviously not terribly reliable. You can see that he writes such wonderful love poetry, you could see why four people fell for him. His first marriage was to another poet called Bela Akhmadulina, whom he had married in 1954. And this is number 12, and it's called Waiting. Little snapshot of a moment in a love affair. My love will come, will fling open her arms and fold me in them, will understand my fears, observe my changes, in from the pouring dark, from the pitch night, without stopping to bang the taxi door. She'll run upstairs through the decaying porch, burning with love and love's happiness. She'll run dripping upstairs. She won't knock, will take my head in her hands. And when she drops her overcoat on a chair, it will slide to the floor in a blue heap. By the time he wrote this poem in 1956, he tells us, the personal, intimate poetry, which had been almost taboo under Stalin, had broken through and was flooding newspapers and magazines. Another result was that of the thaw was that writers were allowed to travel abroad, and Yevtushenko was a particular favorite with the foreign countries who were looking for another poet. Zima Junction particularly had established him, and other poems had brought demand for his appearance in various countries, and he quickly took advantage of this. In that first poem I read you, he writes, and it's not on your sheet, "Frontiers are in my way." I feel like that, you know, frontiers are in my way. "It is embarrassing for me not to know Buenos Aires and New York. I want to walk at will through London and talk with everyone, even in broken English. I want to ride through Paris in the morning, hanging onto a bus like a boy. I want to be as diverse as my... I want art to be as diverse as myself. And what if art be my torment and harass me on every side? I am already by art besieged." And by 1961, he had already travelled widely. Europe, Africa, Cuba, and the USA. In doing so, he not shut himself off as a Russian communist. He had gone out, he had spoken freely, he had read his poetry to large audiences. And people said he must be in well with the Russian government to be allowed to do this. One result of this wide travelling was a spate of poems on slightly different subjects. On the cities he saw, for example, a whole section of his 1962 collection is called A Wave of the Hand, Poems About Abroad, where he gathered together verses on England, France, Catalonia, Bulgaria, Ghana, Liberia, and Togo. He would also write a number of poems inspired by America, and he subsequently went to America for half the year. I think he still goes half the year to teach Russian cinema but no, actually world cinema to American students, and he teaches Russian and European poetry. He's a professional actress, I told you. I love his poem Encounter, which I will read to you, about Ernest Hemingway. He loved Ernest Hemingway. It's funny, isn't it? William Boyd yesterday is obviously very admiring. There's something about Hemingway that appeals to men, I've decided. It doesn't appeal to me quite so much as he does to them. He loved his extreme terseness and his lofty, essential virility. The last six lines have been omitted from your sheet, so just listen carefully at the end. Encounter. We were sitting about taking coffee in the Aerodrome Cafe at Copenhagen, where everything was brilliance and comfort and stylish to the point of tedium. The old man suddenly appeared, or rather happened, like an event of nature. In an ordinary greenish anorak, his face scarred by the salt and burning wind, ploughing a furrow through the crowded room and walking like a sailor from the wheel. His beard was like the white foam of the sea, brimming and glistening round his face. His gruffness and his winner's certainty sent up a wave around him as he walked through the old fashion, aping modern fashions, and modern fashions aping old fashions. He in his open collar and rough shirt, stepping aside from Vermouth and Pernod, stood at the bar demanding Russian vodka and waving away soda with a no. He with the scars marking his tanned forearms, his filthy trousers and his noisy shoes, had better style than anyone in the crowd. The solid ground seemed to quiver underneath the heavy authority of that tread. Somebody smiled across. "Look at that, you'd think that was Hemingway," he said, expressed in details of his short gestures and heavy motions of his fisherman's walk. He was a statue, sketch in a rough rock, one treading down bullets and centuries, one walking like a man hunched in a trench, pushing aside people and furniture. It was the very image of Hemingway. Later, I heard that it was Hemingway. And now we have arrived at Babi Yar. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to just play you the first bit of him reciting it after a short snip of Shostakovich's symphony, which was, of course, based on this poem, Babi Yar. Babi Yar is the name of a ravine near Kiev where many thousands of Jews were massacred by the Nazis and buried during the Second World War, an event swept under the carpet by the Soviet authorities. And I just want to play you a short extract, because when he reads the English, you've got a different translation. I was unable to find you a translation that coincided with the one I had. Thank you. And then be ready to switch it off for me, if you wouldn't mind. Yes, and shall we have a little bit of, can they see it?
Thank you. как грубое надгробие. Мне страшно. Мне сегодня столько лет, как самому еврейскому народу. No monument stands over Paddy Yar, a drop sheer as a crude gravestone. I'm afraid today I'm as old in years as all the Jewish people. Now I seem to be a Jew. Here I plod through ancient Egypt. Here I perish crucified on the cross. To this day I bear the scars of nails. I seem to be Dreyfus, the Philistine is both informer and judge. Behind bars, beset in every side, hounded, spat on, slandered, squealing, dainty ladies and flounced. Brussels lace, stick, silk parcels to my face.
I didn't want you to hear the rest of it because I think it's not as easy if you haven't got the right translation. And I don't necessarily think we should read the whole of it, but it is a very powerful poem. You have it on your sheet. I think you should go back to it. But the reason I want to read it to you is not just because it's one of his best known poems, but also because it does show that Yevtushenko did not hesitate to say to the Russian government, you were wrong. You did this, you didn't acknowledge it. The Russian line was that it was the massacre of Russian citizens, not that it was a massacre of the Jews, which it clearly was. He read it out in Moscow, and there were so many people, not just the Jewish people. As he says, I haven't any Jewish blood in my veins, and yet it's my shame and my responsibility to say something about this. The 13th Symphony, which Shostakovich wrote around this work and some of his other poems, he says of that, he says, morality is a sister of conscience. And perhaps God is with Yevtushenko when he speaks of conscience. And every morning, apparently, Shostakovich, instead of prayers, he says, he rereads or repeats by memory two poems by Yevtushenko. Certainly easier to concentrate on Yevtushenko, I should think, for him. The courage and independence he showed in criticizing the authorities did not go unpunished, especially after he compounded his sins by a visit to Paris in February 1963 by reading out his poem, The Dead Hand of the Past, which opens, and it isn't on your sheet, someone is still living as of old, attempting to knife whatever's new. Someone still glares in the Stalin manner, looking at young men askance. It's harder to unclench a fist if the fist is that of a dead hand. At the same time, his frank autobiography, considered unpublishable in Russia because of its criticism of the state, was being published serially in a French magazine, and for a time he was not allowed to travel. He was immediately recalled to the Soviet Union, and a clampdown on his traveling followed. And nevertheless, undeterred, he carried on publishing and writing what he felt needed to be said about the Russian state. He loves Russia, you can tell. He loves Russia, and he wants his country to be worthy of themselves, and he goes on writing. The year 1966 had marked the end of the thaw under Khrushchev with a series of trials against writers. And so, until fairly recently, it has gone on, resulting, as Yevtushenko points out, in a poem written as the repression seemed finally to be lifting, as loss. Russia, he says, has lost Russia in Russia. Russia searches for itself. While many people respected Yevtushenko for his poetry and his political stance, particularly in the West, There were also those, especially in his own country, who implied that he must have done a deal with those in power to be allowed such freedom of movement. He's been accused of being a clever, albeit liberal, political opportunist, who at times, who times his so-called daring utterances with exquisite precision and is quick to recant when his outspokenness gets him into trouble. I don't think this can be true if you look at his life, but I may be prejudiced, of course, because I love his poetry. He himself makes no inflated claims for himself, denying strongly that it was brave of him to protest, as he has done consistently against the regime. In a poem like Talk, which is number 10 on your sheet, he says, "You're a brave man, they tell me. I'm not. Courage has never been my quality. Only I thought it disproportionate so to degrade myself as others did. No foundations trembled. My voice no more than laughed at pompous falsity. I did no more than write. Never demanded. I left out nothing I had thought about. Defended who deserved it. Put a brand on the untalented, the ersatz writer doing what had anyone how to be done. And now they press to tell me I am brave. How sharply our children will be ashamed, taking at last their vengeance for these horrors. Remembering how in so strange a time, common integrity could look like courage." I know you would identify. It seems to me impossible to establish the truth of any of these claims. All we can do is look at the poetry itself and ask ourselves, does it say anything to us? Is it worth reading at all? For me, one outstanding quality of Yevtushenko's work is its intense lyricism about apparently everyday things, which turn in his hands to magic. This is particularly true of his analysis of personal relationships. There's a lovely poem called Colours, which I want you to look at if you've got it, but don't bother if you don't want it. Number 13. It's a very clear but complex description of falling in love through simple imagery of the sun rising, the sun setting, and the watchman who comes out at twilight to guard the place. "When your face appeared over my crumpled life, at first I understood only the poverty of what I have, then its particular light on woods, on rivers, on the sea, became my beginning in the coloured world in which I had not yet had my beginning. I am so frightened of the unexpected sunrise finishing, of revelations and tears and the excitement finishing. I don't fight it. My love is this fear. I nourish it. Who can nourish nothing, love's slipshod watchman. Fear hems me in. I am conscious that these minutes are short and that the colours in my eyes will vanish when your face sets." Perhaps most importantly of all, there is in the best of Yevtushenko's work a humanity and compassion for the ordinary man and woman in the street with whom he clearly identifies. I want to end my consideration of him where I began it a year ago by reading you one of his wisest and to me most beautiful poems, People. I read it recently at my sister-in-law's funeral, and there wasn't a dry eye at the funeral, because, of course, we know what he's talking about. We know people. We know no people are uninteresting. No people are uninteresting. Their fate is like the chronicle of planets. Nothing in them is not particular, and planet is dissimilar from planet. And if a man lived in obscurity, making his friends in that obscurity, obscurity is not uninteresting. To each, his world is private. private, and in that world, one excellent minute, and in that world, one tragic minute. These are private. If any man who dies there, in any man who dies, there dies with him his first snow and kiss and fight. It goes with him. They are left, books and bridges and painted canvas and machinery, whose fate is to survive. But what has gone is not nothing. By the rule of the game, something has gone. Not people die, but worlds die in them. Whom we knew as faulty, the earth's creatures, of whom, essentially, what did we know? Brother of a brother, friend of friends, lover of lover. We who knew our fathers in everything, in nothing. They perish. They cannot be brought back. The secret worlds are not regenerated. And every time, again and again, I make my lament against destruction. And I just, one word from Yevtushenko to end. Gosh, I've got 2 minutes. I'm so nervous about keeping you waiting. But I liked what he said. I want to quote you what he said to what he took to heart as a young poet. A poet has only one indispensable quality, whether he is simple or complicated. People must need him. Poetry, if it's genuine, is not a racing car rushing senselessly round and round a closed track. It is an ambulance rushing to someone's aid. Thank you.